Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 24th, 2003. Today's session is An Hour with the Great Victorian Poets, Session 2 of An Hour with the Poets, presented by David Wee, WED 2003-07. Let's listen in.
Welcome to this session. My name is David Wee. I teach English, literature, and writing at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. This week I'm doing some sessions on poetry under the general topic for the healing of the world. Although the reading of Billy Collins we did yesterday was the healing of laughter much of the time. This is not going to be a big hour of laughs. So, you know, just to warn you in advance.
You're going to make up for the Bible studies.
Oh, okay.
But appreciate it.
Well, this session is entitled An Hour with the Great Victorian Poets. And their writings on suffering and getting through some of the hard times of life. I've been teaching Victorian literature in college for 38 years now. And I thought when I started that maybe some point along the way I'd get tired of the Victorians and want to move on to modern literature or, you know, something bizarre. But the Victorians have continued to touch me and speak to me and move me whole life. I still get chills reading some of their literature, both the fiction and the poetry, even though I've discussed these things with students for decades and have read them dozens of times, I find it very powerful. Just to kind of refresh your minds, what we call the Victorian Age is the period of time when Queen Victoria was the monarch in Great Britain. Anybody know what years those were? So just a little quiz to see how many English majors are.
1737 to 1803.
Very close. 01. We think that Elizabeth, the current Elizabeth, has been on the throne forever, and that poor Prince Charles has been waiting to assume the throne, and that he may need to wait for another couple decades. But she's only been on the throne for 50 or 51 years. Right. Queen Victoria was 63 and a half years, the monarch. And from 1837 to 1901, and Prince Edward was born in 1840. He had to wait till he was 61 years old before he became the king. So.
And wasn't England the world power at that time?
It was, yeah, it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they rolled the seas, and during the Victorian Age, the British Empire spread throughout the world. Still, there are vestiges of it all over. And the phrase, the sun never sets on the British Empire, was true. Every place around the globe, the sun was shining on some part of the British Empire. Many of the things the Victorians thought about and worried about and cared about were similar to the things we do today, and that's one reason their literature still speaks to me. They were worried about excessive industrialization, about population shifts, in their case, from the country into the city, about labor management relations and all the corrupt profiteering that was going on in industry. They worried about empire, spreading empire. Most of them thought it was a wonderful thing to do because they were bringing higher civilization of England to the barbarians of the world who hadn't had as advanced a civilization as the British had. And in actuality, much of their reason was to get cheap natural resources for manufacturing and so forth. It was the rise of the middle class. Maybe we're having the demise of the real middle class in our culture now, but it used to be the aristocrats and the poor. But during the 19th century, the manufacturing class developed and pollution happened. There was so much child labor and all human labor in the mines and in the factories in the first half of the 19th century that for the first time in known human history, human stature declined. The average height of an adult person in Great Britain diminished by 2 inches because they were getting so little fresh air and food and nourishment and all of that. So a lot of the things that we fuss about in terms of environmental issues and care of the poor and social services were on the minds of the Victorians as well. And like all of us, the Victorians were worried about health, healing, and death and loss. And what I wanted to do today within the summer's theme was to read to you some of the poetry that I find very significant and pleasurable and touching, as many Victorians wrote about loss. I'm going to start out with Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Most of us know a little bit more about Robert Browning than about Elizabeth Barrett Browning, but she was famous long before he was. People thought that she should be the next poet laureate after Wordsworth was to die. And Robert Browning fell in love with first her poetry and then with her. And their love affair is one of the most exotic and romantic love stories in recent history. She was an invalid and had a father who was tyrannical, didn't want any of his children to marry. He'd lost his wife. He wanted all the children at home caring for him and wouldn't let Elizabeth especially have any suitors, anyone courting her. And she was an invalid, and she used to have soirees in the house where all the literary elite of London would come and they'd talk about poetry. Robert Browning came to a couple of those, sat in the corner, throbbing, and ultimately he kidnapped her. He came one night when he knew the father was gone, kidnapped her. They went across the channel to Europe and to Italy, and the father never forgave her or him. He returned every letter unopened that they wrote to him. You know, it was that sort of a situation. They were madly in love. Anyway, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who's most famous for Sonnets from the Portuguese, her series of love sonnets to Robert Browning, wrote a poem about war that I've thought of often in the last few months. It's called Mother and Poet. She wrote it in 1861. The voice in the poet is the voice of Laura Savio, an Italian woman who was a poet and well known and occasionally called upon to write poems for civic occasions. She wrote this in the situation of the poem is the mother, this poet is a mother of two sons, and they're fighting in the war for liberation and unification of Italy, which happened in 1861. Dead. One of them shot by the sea in the east, and one of them shot in the west by the sea. dead, both my boys. When you sit at the feast and are wanting a great song for Italy free, let none look at me. Yet I was a poetess only last year, and good at my art, for a woman, men said. But this woman, this, who is agonized here, the East Sea and West Sea rhyme on in her head forever instead. What art can a woman be good at? Oh, vain. What art is she good at but hurting her breast with the milk teeth of babes and a smile at the pain? Ah, boys, how you hurt. You were strong as you pressed, and I proud by that test. What art's for a woman? To hold on her knees both darlings, to feel all their arms round her throat, cling, strangle a little, to sew by degrees, embroider the long clothes and neat little coat, to dream and to dote. To teach them, it stings there. I made them indeed speak plain the word country. I taught them, no doubt, that a country's a thing men should die for at need. I prated of liberty, rights, and about the tyrant cast out. And when their eyes flashed, oh, my beautiful eyes, I exulted, nay, let them go forth at the wheels of the guns, and denied not. But then the surprise when one sits quite alone. Then one weeps, then one kneels. God, how the house feels. Both of her sons are in the army. At first, happy news came in gay letters moiled with my kisses of camp life and glory and how they both loved me and soon coming home to be spoiled in return would fan off every fly from my brow with their green laurel bough. Then was triumph at Turin, and Kona was free, and someone came out of the cheers in the street with a face pale as stone to say something to me. My Guido was dead. I fell down at his feet while they cheered in the street. I bore it. Friends soothed me. My grief looked sublime as the ransom of Italy. One boy remained to be leaned on and walked with, recalling the time when the first grew immortal, while both of us strained to the height he had gained. And letters still came, shorter, sadder, more strong, writ now but in one hand. And she quotes his letter. I was not to faint. One loved me for two, would be with me ere long. And viva l'Italia! He died for our saint who forbids our complaint. The living son says, you know, we mustn't mourn too much. Guido's death. My nanny would add, this is her other son, he was safe and aware of a presence that turned off the balls, that's the cannonballs, a presence that is casting aside the cannonballs, was impressed it was Guido himself, who knew what I could bear and how 'twas impossible, quite dispossessed, to live on for the rest. On which, without pause, up the telegraph line swept smoothly the next news from Gaeta. Shot. Tell his mother. Their mother, not mine. No voice says, my mother again to me. What? You think Guido forgot? That is to protect you from a bullet. Our souls straight so happy that dizzy with heaven they drop earth's affections, conceive not of woe? I think not. Themselves were too lightly forgiven through that love and sorrow which reconciled so the above and below. I think he references to the love of God for us. O Christ of the five wounds, who lookst through the dark to the face of thy mother, consider, I pray, how we common mothers stand desolate. Mark, whose sons, not being Christ's, die with eyes turned away and no last word to say. both boys did. But that's out of nature. We all have been patriots, yet each house must always keep one. To an imbecile, hewing out roads to a wall. And when Italy's made, for what end is it done if we have not a son? Ah, 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 when Gaeta's taken, what then? When the fair wicked queen sits no more at her sport of the fireballs of death crushing souls out of men, when the guns of Cavalli with final retort have cut the game short, when the last battles for unification happened, what then? When Venice and Rome keep their new jubilee, when your flag takes all heaven for its white, green, and red, when you have your country from mountain to sea, when King Victor has Italy's crown on his head, and I have my dead. What then? Do not mock me. Ring your bells low and burn your lights faintly. My country is there, above the star, pricked by the last peak of snow. My Italy's there, with my brave civic pair to disfranchise despair. Forgive me. Some women bear children in strength and bite back the cry of their pain and self-scorn. But the birth pangs of nations will wring us at length into wails such as this. And we sit on forlorn when the man-child is born. Dead. One of them shot by the sea in the east, and one of them shot in the west by the sea. Both my boys. If in keeping the feast you want a great song for your Italy free, let none look at me. The price of war, freedom, unification of country is that to a mother. And I think very powerful poem to remind us of that, especially at times like this.
Reminds me of the poem that Abraham Lincoln wrote to that Mrs. Bixby. Have you ever seen that letter? It's a famous letter. It was quoted at the beginning of the movie Saving Private Ryan.
That anyone wishes to make after any one of these, please do. Here's a short one by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Tennyson was born the same year Abraham Lincoln was born, 1809. And when Wordsworth died in 1850, he became the poet laureate, partly because Queen Victoria loved his poem In Memoriam, from which I'll read shortly. This is a brief poem. It's just 16 lines. And again, it's about loss and absence. Break, break, break on thy cold gray stones, O sea. And I would that my tongue could utter the thoughts that arise in me. Oh, well for the fisherman's boy that he shouts with his sister at play. Oh, well for the sailor lad that he sings in his boat on the bay. And the stately ships go on to their haven under the hill, but oh, for the touch of a vanished hand and the sound of a voice that is still. Break, Break, break at the foot of thy crags, O sea. But the tender grace of a day that is dead will never come back to me. Very simple statement of the sense of loss, of absence. And standing at the edge of the sea, looking at the, and listening to the waves, bought that from Tennyson. Tennyson wrote one of the most famous elegies in our language. It's called In Memoriam, which means in memory. And it was in memory of his college friend, Arthur Henry Pelham. So it's quite unusual. Most, you know, elegies are written about famous people or to a partner or a child or a parent. This one was for his college friend, and it took him 17 years after Hallam died in 1833, before Tennyson was done with this and published this in 1850. About 100 pages poem, about 130 different sections, and Tennyson worked and reworked them, reorganized them, and so forth. All the poems are written in the same stanza form, four lines of iambic tetrameter in every stanza. And the stanza has become so famous that it's called the In Memoriam stanza because of how it was used so well in this poem. I'm not going to read all 130 sections. I'm going to read just five or six, and some short ones. But it's fascinating to see the different moods and the different stages of grief that one goes through, and this poem documents all of it. Just a word about Hallam. I try to tell my students at college to imagine that their roommate was the captain of the basketball team, the president of the choir, Phi Beta Kappa, summa cum laude, president of the student body, and engaged to your sibling. That's who Hallam was. He was, in the eyes of Tennyson and others of his class, the very brightest person. I ask my students to imagine if this roommate of yours, everyone in the whole college was convinced it was going to be the president of the United States within a couple decades. That's the sort of person that Hallam was. And the crushing thing was that Hallam was engaged to Tennyson's sister, so he was looking forward to a lifetime of family with Hallam. But in the sections I'll read, I'll just say a few words about each one as we go. In section 5, he talks about how important it is to express his grief in poetry. Why it is that he's writing poetry to express his grief, but that words can't even begin to touch the kind of despair that he's suffering. 12 lines here. I sometimes hold it half a sin to put in words the grief I feel. For words, like nature, half reveal and half conceal the soul within. But for the unquiet heart and brain, a use in measured language lies. The sad mechanic exercise, like dull narcotics, numbing pain. The rhythms, the regular rhythms of poetry, are like a narcotic to numb the pain. In words, like weeds, that's morning clothes, is to use the word weeds for that. I'll wrap me o'er like coarsest clothes against the cold. But that large grief which these enfold is given an outline and no more. So just like when back in Minnesota we're going through the winter with our down coats, you can't really tell the real shape of anyone because, you know, we're all so covered up. Tennyson's trying to make the point that the words, even of a good poem, only partly reveal the internal grief. And then he talks about the criticisms that he got from other people as he grieved. And how other people would try to console him or criticize him. And this poem, which is a little bit longer, about 40 lines, is quite telling. One writes that, quote, other friends remain, that loss is common to the race. Everybody dies. Common thing. This is what we say to people to try to comfort them. And common is the commonplace, and vacant chaff well meant for grain. That loss is common would not make my own less bitter, rather more. The fact that such a loss is common to the human condition makes me not less bitter, but more bitter. Too common, never mourning more to evening, but some heart did break. Then he gives three little scenarios. O Father, wheresoever thou be, who pledgest now thy gallant son, raising a glass somewhere, a shot, ere half thy draft be done, hath stilled the life that beat from thee. So just at the very moment that a father might be raising a glass to his son in the army before he's even drunk it, half his son somewhere on the other side of the world has been killed. O Mother, praying God will save thy sailor, while thy head is bowed, his heavy-shotted hammock shroud drops in his vast and wandering grave. He's being buried at sea, even while the mother is in prayer for his safety. Ye know no more than I who wrought at that last hour to please him well, who mused on all I had to tell, and something written, something thought, expecting still his advent home, and ever met him on his way with wishes, thinking, here today or here tomorrow will he come. Just Tennyson thinking about his friend. And then here's a third example. Oh, somewhere, meek, the unconscious dove that sittest ranging golden hair, comb your hair in front of a mirror, and glad to find thyself so fair, poor child that waitest for thy love. For now her father's chimney glows in expectation of a guest, and thinking this will please him best, she takes a riband or a rose, for he will see them on tonight, and with the thought her color burns. And having left the glass, she turns once more to set a ringlet right. A woman waiting for her lover to come and visit. And even when she turned, the curse had fallen, and her future lord was drowned in passing through the ford, or killed in falling from his horse. Oh, what to her shall be the end, and what to me remains of good? To her, perpetual maidenhood, and unto me, no second friend. The way you feel sometimes when a loved one is lost and you think, you know, I'm never going to have another friend or loved one or spouse. And the fact that this is a common experience is not a comfort to Tennyson.
How did he die?
He had some kind of seizure. He was a young man. He was 20, 21 or 22, and he was traveling in Italy and had a seizure and just died suddenly. Here's a poem which I'll just read the conclusion. This is section 21. Tennyson refers to the way in which people criticize him. You know, you shouldn't be making such a show of your grief. Come on, get over it, move on. Life goes on, and you can't spend your time grieving when the Victorian age is moving on to all its wonderful scientific advances. And after quoting a number of these criticisms, he ends with these two stanzas. Behold, Ye speak an idle thing. Ye never knew the sacred dust. Ye never knew him. I do but sing because I must, and pipe but as the linnets sing. That's a bird. And one is glad, her note is gay, for now her little ones have ranged. And one is sad, her note is changed, because her brood is stolen away. Even the birds weep and can't sing the same if a predator has come and stolen the chicks. And we're very much like birds in that respect. Then in section 48, again, which is just 16 lines, Tennyson is trying to explain that the kind of grief poetry he writes is not the kind of thing to answer the big questions of life. Why me? Or why does chance rule in this way? He's trying to suggest, because he was seen as an intellectual leader of the country eventually, that he should not be criticized because his poems aren't solving all the theological questions we have about life and the hereafter. If these brief lays, that is these poems, if these brief lays of sorrow born were taken to be such as closed grave doubts and answers here proposed, then these were such as men might scorn. You might ridicule my poetry if you think it's going to be so profound. Her care, that is sorrow's care, is not to part and prove. She takes, when harsher moods remit, what slender shade of doubt may flit, and makes it vassal unto love. And hence indeed she sports with words, but better serves a wholesome law, and holds it sin and shame to draw the deepest measure from the cords. Nor dare she trust a larger lay. Sorrow doesn't trust an epic poem, but rather loosens from the lip short swallow flights of song that dip their wings in tears and skim away. That's his description of these poems. Short swallow flights of song that dip their wings in tears and skim away. They're better than that, really. Wasn't bragging. And then one other section, as I mentioned, this whole poem moves through all the stages of grief and ups and downs and several years of time, Christmases and New Year's and so forth. And they're all sad, and it ultimately comes to a very profound religious and positive conclusion. But this section, some of you may remember hearing this, section 106, is called the Ring Out section, because it's written to recognize New Year's. And at midnight on New Year's Eve, in Great Britain, all the parish churches ring their bells. So there's just this glorious sound of church bells ringing all over the countryside, and everyone is close enough to at least one parish church to be hearing bells. So this one, he's thinking about those bells. Ring out, wild bells, to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light. The year is dying in the night. Ring out, wild bells, and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. And then he starts listing the very kinds of things that we here at Holden are talking about that we want to kind of get out of our cultural life and our spiritual lives. Ring out the grief that saps the mind, for those that here we see no more. Ring out the feud of rich and poor. Ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer laws. Bring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. He wants to have more joyous poetry. Ring out false pride in place and blood, the civic slander and the spite. Ring in the love of truth and right. Ring in the common love of good. Ring out old shapes of foul disease. Ring out the narrowing lust of gold. Ring out the thousand wars of old. Ring in the thousand years of peace. Ring in the valiant man and free, the larger heart, the kindlier mind, kindlier hand. Ring out the darkness of the land. Ring in the Christ that is to be. Lots of echoes of the things we pray for in that poem, published in 1850, 153 years ago. Then one poem by Robert Browning. Many of the Victorian poems are fairly long, and you know I don't want to read many 100-line poems for you, or 500-line poems. And many of Browning's really good poems are fairly long and highly interesting, but typically on other topics. But here's one called Prospici, which means look forward. And it's very much in some ways like Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. It's kind of talking about facing death in a strong and positive way. And this poem is 28 lines. It has an interesting shift at the end. Fear death, to feel the fog in my throat, the mist in my face. When the snows begin and the blasts denote, I am nearing the place. The power of the night, the press of the storm, the post of the foe. Where he stands, the arch fear, capitalized, this is Satan, in a visible form, yet the strong man must go. For the journey is done and the summit attained and the barriers fall. Though a battle's to fight, ere the guerdon be gained, the reward of it all. I was ever a fighter, so one fight more, the best and the last. I would hate that death bandaged my eyes and forbore and bade me creep past. No, let me taste the whole of it. Fare like my peers, the heroes of old. Bear the brunt. In a minute, pay glad life's arrears of pain, darkness, and cold. For sudden, the worst turns the best to the brave. The black minutes at end, and the elements rage, the fiend voices that rave, shall dwindle, shall blend, shall change, shall become first a peace out of pain, then a light, then thy breast, O thou soul of my soul, I shall clasp thee again, and with God be the rest. We find at the end that he's really been addressing his wife, and his wife had died before, and as all the struggle of death diminishes, he's going to be able to embrace her again. Christina Rossetti. She's most famous for her poem Goblin Market, which is one of the favorites for my students to discuss because it's sort of like a fairy tale, and yet it's got dark corners to it that are fascinating. You all know what it was like for women in the Victorian age. It was a patriarchal society. They didn't have careers like are available to women today. They were secondary creatures and always dependent, like the young woman in Tennyson's poem, you know, preparing for her beloved to come. If Mr. Wright didn't come and marry a young woman, then she might have a life that the Victorians used to call fate worse than death, meaning spinsterhood. And there were, during the Victorian age, there were several million more women than men in the country. So without good jobs other than being governesses or barmaids or prostitutes, you know, Victorian women who didn't get married were in a tough situation. What Christina Rossetti does is to, she has a feminist voice in some of her pieces, and I think you'll grin at a couple of these short poems by Christina Rossetti, because she breaks all the stereotypes of what it should be like for a Victorian woman. This one is simply called Song, and it's about death, and her more famous brother, Dante Rossetti, had written a poem called The Blessed Damozel, in which a woman has died, has gone to heaven. She, and Rossetti painted pictures of this, departed woman leaning over the balconies of heaven, weeping at Mr. Wright, who was still alive down on earth, and now they're separated and of course, weeping. Here's Christina Rossetti's comment to her beloved, should she die. When I am dead, my dearest, sing no sad songs for me. Plant thou no roses at my head, nor shady cypress tree. Be the green grass above me with showers and dewdrops wet. And if thou wilt, remember. And if thou wilt, forget. I shall not see the shadows. I shall not feel the rain. I shall not hear the nightingale sing on as if in pain. And dreaming through the twilight that doth not rise nor set, haply I may remember, and haply may forget. By chance, I may remember you, and maybe I won't. It's hard for men of the time to, you know, hear that from a woman. I mean, hard for women too, because you know that we have this, and this is still an enduring thing. We have the sense that, you know, when we die, we're going to be remembered on Memorial Day, at least, you know, and other times, and that we're going to be missed. And here's somebody saying, "Don't worry about it." And she has written one called "No Thank You, John." And this is a fun rejection poem. "I never said I loved you, John. Why will you tease me day by day and wax a weariness to think upon with always do and pray? You know I never loved you, John. No fault of mine made me your toast. Why will you haunt me with a face as wan as shows an hour old ghost? I dare say Meg or Moll would take pity upon you if you'd ask. And pray don't remain single for my sake, who can't perform that task. I have no heart? Perhaps I have not. But then you're mad to take offense that I don't give you what I have not got." Use your own common sense. "Let bygones be bygones. Don't call me false, who owed not to be true. I'd rather answer no to 50 Johns than answer yes to you." "Let's mar our pleasant days no more, songbirds of passage, days of youth. Catch at today, forget the days before. I'll wink at your untruth. Let us strike hands as hearty friends, no more, no less. And friendship's good, only don't keep in view ulterior ends and points not understood in open treaty. Rise above quibbles and shuffling off and on. Here's friendship for you if you like, but love, no thank you, John."
When did the expression "Dear John" letter?
I don't know.
At would be a legitimate source.
Yeah. I'll save that joke till later. I've got a lame pun to report, but this is the wrong moment, I guess.
Then your stops Keith.
Right. That was a dyslexic where it was, instead of John Deere, it was
yeah, but that's the punchline of the joke. A guy whose wife ran off with an implement dealer, she sent him a John Deere letter. I think we'll end with Thomas Hardy, who I think is one of the most powerful of the Victorian poets. Many people think of him as a 20th century poet. He was born in 1840, so he was 61 years old by the time the Victorian age ended. But he had been primarily famous as a novelist. And you know, most of us have read or heard of The Return of the Native and Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and you know, he wrote about 25 novels. And finally, his last two novels drew so much public criticism, Tess of the D'Urbervilles and Jude the Obscure, which he wrote in 1891 and 1894, denounced from pulpits all over the land, scathing reviews, that he said, that's it. I'm not writing any more novels. And he spent the last 30 years of his life writing poetry. He had written some poetry earlier. And so his poetry, is much of it is 20th century. But I find it extremely moving. This one's called The Impercipient. It's a 32-line poem. Impercipient means the one who can't see, the one who can't perceive. And this is a powerful poem for me as I think about our response as believers to those who are not believers. And the voice here is the person who is an unbeliever attending a cathedral service where all the Christians are worshiping. That with this, and by the way, this poem, every other line, all the way to 32, has the same rhyming sound, a long E sound. Do you think that's easy to do? Try it sometime without sounding completely absurd. The Impercipient. That with this bright believing band I have no claim to be, that faiths by which my comrades stand seem fantasies to me, and mirage mists their shining land is a strange destiny. That everything that others believe in just be unbelievable to me. Why thus my soul should be consigned to infelicity? Why always must I feel as blind to sights my brethren see? Why joys they have found I cannot find abides a mystery. Since heart of mine knows not that ease which they know, since it be that he who breathes all's well to these breathes no all's well to me, my lack might move their sympathies in Christian charity, because I don't feel the presence of a God. You'd think these believers would be sympathetic toward a sad person like me missing this. I'm like a gazer who should mark an inland company standing up fingered with, hark, hark, the glorious distant sea, and feel, alas, 'tis but yon dark and windswept pine to me. All I can see is the forest. Yet I would bear my shortcomings with meek tranquility, but for the charge that blessed things I liefer not have be. O, doth a bird be shorn of wings, go earthbound willfully? The thing that grinds the speaker the most is that all the believers are saying, you don't want to believe it. You know, you wanted to believe that it happened, but you're willfully disbelieving. And he says, you know, doth a bird be shorn of wings, go earthward willfully? This is what's really hard when the believers are not nice and understanding. Got about 10 more minutes, and then I'll read a few more. I think one of the best poems in the 19th century is Hardy's Neutral Tones. And it's 16 lines, four-line stanzas. The speaker here could be either male or female. We tend to believe that a speaker of a poem who was written by a male must be a male speaker, but if you listen carefully, this could be a man addressing a woman who isn't there, or a woman addressing a man who isn't there. Listen to the description of this recollection of what it was like the day that he realized their love for each other was dead. We stood by a pond that winter day, and the sun was white as though chidden of God, as though chided by God. And a few leaves lay on the starving sod. They had fallen from an ash and were gray. Your eyes on me were as eyes that rove over tedious riddles solved years ago. Anybody looks at you with that look in their eyes. And some words played between us to and fro on which lost the more by our love. That's an odd sentence to understand, but some of my students explained to me what it means. That's about 30 years ago. The words that we talked about that were playing to and fro were on the subject of which one of us is worse off because of our relationship. If you get into that kind of a discussion, things are in danger.
What? Would you read those lines?
Yeah. And some words played between us to and fro on which lost the more by our love. The words just playing back and forth of which of us is worse off because of our love for each other. And then this one. The smile on your mouth was the deadest thing alive enough to have strength to die. And a grin of bitterness swept thereby like an ominous bird away. Now the last stanza, the speaker is saying, since then, so we know that what he's described here is what that day was like. Since then, keen lessons that love deceives and rings with wrong have shaped to me your face and the God-cursed sun and a tree and a pond edged with grayish leaves. Every time since then that I've learned the hard lesson that love deceives, immediately that day flashes into mind and I see the whole thing over again. Here's a short 12-line poem about what it's like to be growing older and older and not having the vigor that you remember. Yes. This is called, I Look Into My Glass, that is, into my mirror. I look into my glass and view my wasting skin and say, would God it came to pass my heart had shrunk as thin as my skin. For then I, undistressed by hearts grown cold to me, could lonely wait my endless rest with equanimity. But time, to make me grieve, heart steals, lets part abide, and shakes this fragile frame at eve with throbbings of noontide. Mm-hmm. When we get old and decrepit, we still have that remembrance or sense of being young, and that's the hardest thing. Two more. This one is bittersweet, painfully funny. It's called, Are You Digging on My Grave? And it's one of these question and answer poems. And the first two lines of each six-line stanza are spoken by a dead person from the grave underground. And the last four lines are answered by another voice, which isn't identified immediately. And it's six stanzas. Ah, are you digging on my grave, my loved one, planting rue, flowers? The boy says, no, yesterday he went to wed one of the brightest wealth has bred. It cannot hurt her now, he said, that I should not be true. Then who is digging on my grave, my nearest, dearest kin? Ah, no, they sit and think, what use? What good will planting flowers produce? No tendons of her mound can loose her spirit from death's gin. So first, the boyfriend has gone off to marry somebody else. He's not planting flowers here. See, this is the opposite kind of woman from Christina Rossetti's voice.
Yeah.
This is the woman who wants to know who is remembering. Is it my kin, my family? Now they figure, what good can it do now that she's gone? Won't treat her to death. What someone digs upon my grave, my enemy, prodding sly? Boy says, nay, when she heard you had passed the gate that shuts on all flesh soon or late, she thought you no more worth her hate and cares not where you lie. Then who is digging on my grave? Say, since I have not guessed. The voice answers, oh, it is I, my mistress dear, your little dog, who still lives near, and much I hope my movements here have not disturbed your rest. The dog remembers. And the voice says, in a full stanza this time, ah, yes, you dig upon my grave. Why flashed it not on me that one true heart was left behind? What feeling do we ever find to equal among humankind a dog's fidelity? The last stanza is the dog's answer. Mistress, I dug upon your grave to bury a bone in case I should be hungry near this spot when passing on my daily trot. I'm sorry, but I quite forgot it was your resting place. And here's the last one. This moves me immensely. It's called The Walk, and it's about two partners. It's in the voice of the partner who has obviously lost his beloved recently, but someone who has been an invalid for years. And this is just 16 lines. The Walk.
And who's written these last ones?
Thomas Hardy.
Oh, these are
still
Hardy.
Thomas Hardy. Yeah. You did not walk with me of late to the hilltop tree by the gated ways as in earlier days. You were weak and lame, so you never came. And I went alone, and I did not mind not thinking of you as left behind. I walked up there today just as in the former way, surveyed around the familiar ground by myself again. What difference then? Only that underlying sense of the look of a room on returning thence. He's been walking up here alone for years because she's been an invalid, but now it's different just because of the sense of her absence back when he gets there. And that's, I think the Victorians were eloquent in talking about the sadness of loss, emptiness, and sometimes hilarious as Hardy and Christina Rossetti were. But as we think about the healing that we all need and ways of getting through loss and hard times and ill health, I find that returning to the Victorians is as good as anything going. Well, thank you for coming and just go out into the brightness.